It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law. And again, you can reach us at an 800 number or 247-7282 or 353-4674. And what are we talking about today, gentlemen?
Ben, we're going to go back for one more week and talk a little bit more about elder law. We've discussed it the past two or three weeks. Mm-hmm. There's some general issues that we want to talk about, some of the documents that we deal with and prepare and interpret and deal with from maybe other lawyers or, you know, clients who have been mm-hmm. to other attorneys bring to us, just these very important documents. But before we get into that, I do want to circle back and provide a little bit more information with regard to a call that we had last week at the end of the program. Mm-hmm. The call was along the lines of transfers mm-hmm. or gifts mm-hmm. Because we were discussing the issue that in the event that we need to make application for adult Medicaid,
right?
Let's say someone is in the nursing home, we're needing to make that application. We were talking about the twists and turns of gifting of assets, and we were making the comment that you can't just, let's say, put your assets into someone else's name to become eligible mm-hmm. because it's means tested. You can only have a certain amount of countable assets to become eligible. We talked about the fact that, you know, if you transfer assets, the value of those transfers is basically divided by $5,500, and that's the amount of months that you don't have Medicaid cover your care, which is called a sanction period. Mm-hmm. So the caller, I think from Atlantic Beach, great caller, called in and said, well, what if you make a gift to your church? Mm-hmm. What if you tithe? What mm-hmm. if you're doing some charitable giving? And the general rule with regard to that is that any type of gift that's uncompensated is going to be countable, is going to be considered when we're looking at that sanction period. Mm-hmm. And that's generally how the conversation went, but I do want to add an exception to that. And mm-hmm. hopefully that listener is listening so that he gets this full information. The exception would be that if you can prove that there has been a gifting plan in place.
Oh, you've had a history?
That's right.
Okay.
A tithe. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to just be a tithe, but that, you know, you've been consistently a pattern, if you will, of giving to this particular charity, I think.
Right. So, I mean, well, it could be any charity. I mean, it could be, you know, if you normally give
$1,000
a year to your college, you know, or
easily shown by your tax record.
Correct.
That's right. So, you know, you could make, you know, a case for just about any type of charitable giving, mm-hmm. to try to show that there was a pattern and therefore I did not make this gift for the purpose of becoming eligible for the Medicaid.
And that's because I always do it.
That's really the crux of it. Mm-hmm. But if we don't have that history and we find out, okay, we're $30,000 away from Medicaid, I'm going to give that to my church because I was going to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. That won't work. That will be a sanctionable transfer. Yeah. So that's kind of in the law, as we've talked about before, we oftentimes have the rule and mm-hmm. then we have the multiple exceptions.
Right.
So the rule would be any transfer of a countable asset, with some exceptions, would be a sanctionable transfer except for the pattern. You mm-hmm. can show the history, the pattern of the gifting to charitable.
Okay. All right. So
donation type
thing. It doesn't have to be that you have a pledge that's outstanding that says you're going to do it, but you have a pattern of
that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, good. Well, that's a great answer to that. Yeah. All right, what else are we talking about?
And, of course, Ben, the reason this question evolves is that it is good just to affirm and state one more time to our listeners that any transfer mm-hmm. within 5 years of qualification of application is going to be sanctioned.
Right.
Any deed transfer, any transfer of money, transfer of a vehicle, mm-hmm. Any transfer of anything of value within 5 years is going to have to be addressed.
Right.
Now, I think statistically, probably at least half of our files, Ben, have facts where there is, where there has been, if you will, a transfer. So, yes, that's the general rule that it has to, that it's going to create a sanction period. The exception to the rule is that we deal with it. There are mechanisms where we are able to undo the sanction period, consider the value that was transferred and, you know, invest it in real property in some way so that the transfer no longer creates a sanction period or a penalty. So there are ways around it.
But
it's like I tell clients all the time, go ahead and tell us all of the facts. Let us make a list of these gifts that you've made to your children. And now we will deal with them above board, you know, in the legal manner in which the law allows us to do so. It just simply is not uncommon at all, Ben. It's a very logical thing that when dad and mom get, or dad begins to get very, very sick and it's a close family, you know, mom turns to son and daughter and says, well, I want you all to have this CD. And she goes to the bank and she puts it in their name. That's just life. That's just what good families do. And we understand that. And so we then take those facts and as lawyers then make those facts fit within the law and make those transfers not sanctionable. So there is work that can be done.
Well, wasn't there a rule change, though, about when you can apply or your application or when that sanction period starts a few years ago?
The sanction period before the what's called the Deficit Reduction Act, which was in 2011-12, began to run from the date that the actual gift was made. And now that changed within the last several years. For that sanction period to not apply until you make application. So, you know, any gift within that 5-year look back period, you can't really wait that out unless you're able to wait 5 years. So that's basically, you know, the way that works.
So, but the application, you can't make the application until you are in need of the services. You have to have the FL2.
That's exactly right, Ben. You circle right back to that FL2, which is the document that the physician would sign indicating that there is an actual need for the skilled nursing level of care. So you have, again, the kind of two-step process there, which is the medical need first. You have to have the medical need first, and then obviously we look at the assets to make a determination as to whether you're eligible.
It seems then that most people then are going to have some out-of-pocket time before they qualify for
Medicaid. Unless they plan ahead. If they plan ahead and they structure their assets in a way so that they would be still available to them but not countable and do it in a way so that there's not a sanction, which there are, you know, many different tools in our toolbox that we use in order to do that depending on the circumstances, then there would not be any private pay period.
I know there may be questions out there about this. If you have questions, you could call now.
Call me at 800-818-2255 or locally at 247-7282 or 353-4674.
I had a question a listener asked me. Does pension, does income count as far as assets go?
Well, you got two things going on there. And you know, if you've got an asset, like an annuity, something like that. Well, and it's available to
that you,
and you
can
cash
it
in, and that's a countable asset.
Right.
That's one thing. And then in the event you have income, which you probably are not going to have, you know, a countable asset like an annuity and be eligible for Medicaid unless you have a surviving spouse who's able to keep that because you're able to use a community spouse resource allowance. Now that gets a little bit technical, but assets as far as, you know, an annuity, a retirement account, any of those kind of things that you can cash in are going to be countable. They're going to kind of go in your column for whether you're eligible or not. So sometimes we're forced into a situation where we have to liquidate those. But then on the other hand, you have income, and that could be, like you say, a pension, some type of retirement, social security, these type of income programs.
It's not something you can cash out.
You can't cash it out. It's just income. Then the way that works is that that in and of itself will not render you ineligible.
Mm-hmm.
But you will lose almost all of that income.
It comes off the top.
That's
basically.
Right. But that's very important to understand. Let's say the husband is the one who needs the Medicaid, needs the care, has become eligible. Then the wife is at home. She's the healthy spouse or what in the law is called the community spouse. Well, we lose all of just the husband's income.
Mm-hmm.
But if the wife is also receiving income, then we don't lose any of hers. But we oftentimes see that the husband is obviously receiving more Social Security,
mm-hmm.
more retirement, because maybe, you know, for obvious reasons, he mm-hmm. worked more, made more money. Maybe she raised the kids, that kind of thing. So that makes it, you know, all the more important for that community spouse for us to protect as many assets as we possibly can. Because in many situations, until her husband is needing this care, they're living off that income.
Right. Exactly.
So we've got to utilize the law that's given to us by utilizing the community spouse resource allowance, mm-hmm. protecting as much asset as we can, so that she's not left destitute or in a situation where she can't make ends meet.
Okay, more to come in a moment here as we take a look at elder law and some of the ramifications around your assets and income as well, too. And then we'll talk about that more coming up in a moment. If you would like to call in, 800-818-2255 are these local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us from Harvell and Collins. And more on Let's Talk Legal right after this. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. We're talking about elder law provisions. Where do we go from here?
Well, you know, we talked at the beginning of the program about gifting and the mm-hmm. 5-year look back period and the sanction period. And, you know, another exception to that, which we don't really see all that often, is the caregiver exception, which is basically what it says in the Medicaid law is that if a family member has provided care mm-hmm. to the person, I think that rule is for a consecutive 12-month period of time.
Right.
I'd have to go back and look at it because we don't use it that often because there's other things that we can do. But just mm-hmm. to be clear for our listeners, if we provided care to the point where the person has not needed the skilled nursing mm-hmm. care during the period of time, then the law then allows us to transfer that asset directly into that family member's name.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to prove that. We would have to have, you know, affidavits from maybe witnesses, other family members, so on and so forth, indicating that, you know, this child has provided this high level of care for this period of time, might even need a doctor's affidavit, you know, indicating that mm-hmm. in the event that this family member, this child has not provided this level of care during this period of time, and the person would have needed skilled nursing care earlier.
Would the person needed to have, again, checked off all the boxes on the FL2 for them to qualify?
You still have the medical need.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
As far as the eligibility goes, but as far as the transfer goes, you know, the transfer can certainly take place before you actually make application,
mm-hmm.
but you still have to show that there was that significant period of time that you would have needed that care anyway.
Right.
So there is that small exception with regard to transferring the home place,
mm-hmm.
But that's a little bit of a sticky wicket because there's a lot of little details involved in that. And if, you know, you make the transfer without, you know, kind of filling all the blanks,
mm-hmm.
then it would be a sanctionable transfer. And as I say, you know, there are other mechanisms that we use in our office in order to protect the asset. We've talked about it before, the use of trust, mm-hmm. a certain type of trust document to make the home place or any other real property not countable under the law and also not subject to what's called the estate recovery or the lien upon the death of the person who's received the Medicaid. So that's one of those exceptions yet again.
Yeah. Again, it's a fascinating part, but as you have often said, as we try to demystify the law around this, that every case has its own twists and turns.
Yeah, no question about that.
Right.
Right.
Where else we go today?
I think Cecil was going to mention some of the other documents that we deal with quite often.
You know, Ben, these ancillary, if you will, miscellaneous documents. Mm-hmm. We always hear on the program talk about the durable power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
I think our listeners hear that about every other program,
yeah,
about the importance of that document. It was so interesting here recently. I read an article, I think it was in one of the major papers, I think maybe the New York Times or maybe it was the Washington Post, but it was a very reputable news organization, and they had a long article about the durable power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually tried to do my best to get it posted to our professional Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's there. And it was just kind of amazing to read that, coming in from a whole nother state.
Mm-hmm.
This problem exists everywhere, that we need desperately to have, the durable power of attorney somewhere in a file. And of course, in this day and age, it needs to be very specific and it needs to be well drafted. You know, a bank, a stock company, the Register of Deeds, if you will, the Department of Motor Vehicles, they're not going to accept some just blanket grant of
mm-hmm.
authority.
Right.
They want it spelled out. They want detail in the power of attorney, particularly stock companies, your holding companies, if you will,
mm-hmm.
for your IRA and your investment accounts at, you know, any number of the, you know, the great brokerage firms, Edward Jones,
right.
A.G. Edwards, Merrill Lynch,
mm-hmm.
you know, Smith Barney, you know, they all want, if you will, and require very specific language before that son or daughter
mm-hmm.
is going to be able to go in there and make transfers within that account, okay? Because if they don't have those specific grants of authority, then they fear that they might be held legally responsible in some
mm-hmm.
way. So not only do we need the document, we need it to be well drafted. I do not suggest that our clients get powers of attorney off the internet, you know, generic powers of attorney from some national organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these vary from state to state.
Right.
Because each state has its very specific laws. Now, here in the last few years, we also at our office now generate a, if you will, general HIPAA release.
Mm-hmm.
The HIPAA release is very important because it gives our loved one the right to our medical records right now.
Mm-hmm.
This could be because our spouse is going through, you know, chemotherapy and can't go get the record.
Right.
Just isn't feeling well to go. So husband can go and get it for her,
mm-hmm.
or son or daughter can go and get it for her.
So is that separate from a healthcare power of attorney?
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It is. Let's keep in mind that the most doctor, our general doctor, our treating doctor, is going to have on file, most likely in all the forms that we fill out when we
oh,
go
sure.
to see a doctor,
oh, yeah.
a HIPAA release, okay? Mm-hmm. But that is pertinent to that particular doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose we are at some other physician or some other hospital, you know, an accident and we're airlifted, if you will, to mm-hmm. Chapel Hill or Duke, there's not going to be we haven't been there previously and signed a HIPAA release at those institutions or at those doctor offices. And so this general, if you will, HIPAA release in your file mm-hmm. is very important because it gives a grant to whoever needs to
mm-hmm.
see that our son, daughter, grandson has authority to our medical records.
We'll have more to come in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Remember, you can find them online at harvellandcollins.com and call to make that appointment too at 726-9050. We'll have more to come in just a bit. Few minutes left here to talk about more on elder law here with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law.
And, you know, Ben, you, during the break, we were talking about these documents, you know, the power of attorney, the health care power of attorney,
mm-hmm.
the HIPAA release, and, of course, the living will or
right.
declaration of desire for natural death. And clients say, you know, similar to what we were talking about, wow, can't we put all that in one document? Well, you know, these documents speak to different people, institutions, companies, if you will, for different purposes. I mean, a healthcare power of attorney is all about giving our loved one the authority to sign consent to anesthesia, consent to diagnostic procedure, surgery, the things that we need when we are in the hospital and are unable to sign because of our sickness. A power of attorney is speaking to a bank or to the register of deeds or to a stock company, as I mentioned before, or an annuity company or to our retired company that we retired from. You know, the two are very, very different. And so consequently, the documents are not going to be documents that can all be combined into one. The HIPAA release is a document, as I just mentioned, that, you know, is generic in that it will apply wherever we happen to have medical care, be it a place that we really didn't plan on being. You know, sometimes in the day and age of specialized medicine, you know, we didn't plan to be over at that very specialized doctor in Greenville or, you know, Chapel Hill or some Duke or wherever. And now all of a sudden, you know, we're wanting our medical records to be sent to our son or daughter. So that's where that HIPAA release comes into play.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And then and storing those documents or making them available to the right people at the right time.
Well, what we do there is we make sure that our clients have a complete conformed copy. We maintain the original in our vault system. We then, as a service to our clients, are more than willing to pull those documents at any time and PDF them, email them, fax them, mail them, overnight them, whatever is necessary in order to help our client, because it is important that these documents all be kept in one place and that they be, and that the sanctity of the original be maintained.
So can you make your own copies?
We make you a copy, as many copies as you want to have. The important thing about a copy is that it be a copy of the signed, notarized witness, that it be a copy of the original. I cannot tell you how many times clients come in the office and they say, here is my will, here is my power of attorney. They've even gotten it from a lawyer's office, and it's a copy of something that is not signed. And I say, well, it's not signed, Mr. Jones. Well, it's signed. We signed it. And I'm like, well, you know, I need to see the signed, notarized, witnessed by two witnesses, the seal. I need to, those details are very, very important.
Find out more by making your appointment with the folks at Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, 252-726-9050. They won't overlook those details. 252-726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, online at harvellandcollins.com.